This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program for the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Now in standard orbit, sir.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
I'm Haley Stoddart. Zach, he's off filming the Green Berets too. So I'm here to discuss the original cast's most, I would say, famous movie among Trekkies especially, but the critically acclaimed Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for being here again. This is twice in 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
So that's good. You know, it gives me a break from Zach. I've had him like 3 or 4 weeks in a row. But you know, what's nice about doing this show is this movie is referred to by many non or kind of quasi Star Trek fans as, oh, the one with the whales, you know, and it did. It had the most universal appeal prior to the JJ movies being launched in 2009.
Yeah, the one with the whales.
With the whales.
Yep. So some fun facts about this. Rotten Tomatoes gave this a 85%. It earned $109 million in 1986. So that would be about $258 million today, making it the third highest domestic box office behind Star Trek 2009, which happens to be my favorite, and Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Which happens to be my favorite. Isn't that funny? So it's interesting. One, I'm impressed that you did that math off the top of your head and that you could figure out the difference between 86 and 2018 so quickly. That's awesome. But secondly, you're right. It did have a lot of appeal. It had a very high score. It did all those things. And really, you know, I think 2009 had a lot of broad appeal because we hadn't seen Star Trek for a while. It was JJ's take on it. It was kind of Star Warsy, and then, of course, a lot of people got into it. And then for Star Trek the Motion Picture, which is, you know, now I feel like I need to be getting in my rocking chair again and talking about the good old days. But you know, when that came out in 79, we hadn't had Star Trek for 11 years other than the animated series. So that was the big return. And this just took off. So the success of Star Trek IV, right, back in the day, it really was a catalyst for Paramount to go ahead and say, okay, we're going to launch a new TV series. And I believe you are a TNG mega fan.
I am. I was five when it started, so I didn't watch it immediately at that point, but yeah.
Yeah, so you know what I'm saying. So yeah, it was huge. I'm a big TNG fan. I was having a good time on Facebook with TNG people this week. But anyway, it really, like, I remember that timeline because everything was just hitting its stride. If you were a Star Trek fan, the conventions were huge. There was a lot of, because Star Trek IV was the 20th anniversary of Star Trek back then. And to think we're doing the 25th anniversary of DS9 right now.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, see.
And the 30th for TNG last year, yeah, it all goes my mind.
Okay, so, you know, I'm not the only old one on the show. I'm just much older.
Yes, you are.
There we go. You don't have to be so fast with that. Anyway. Well, one thing about this movie, though, it was, at the time, right, it was purposely light, but it carried, I thought, a pretty great message, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But first, Haley, you know, when did you watch the movie?
Okay, so I don't recall watching it when I was growing up, so yeah. I might have, but technically watched it two nights ago. Yeah.
Okay. And your first impressions?
You know, I enjoyed it. I think my favorite thing about it was not only the humor, which a lot of people enjoy, but the music for me. I really enjoyed the lightness to it. It was adventurous and fun and upbeat, but it wasn't dark like a lot of the music in all the other films can be.
That's an interesting observation. Now, it's funny you say that, and I did not prompt her to, but the one and only episode I did with Brandon on Melodic Treks was on the score of Star Trek IV. Mm-hmm. You know, by Leonard Rosenman, and it was a very different score. And yeah. We listened to a lot of his different tracks on that. And this, I believe it was nominated for an Academy Award. It didn't win, but it did. It had a really upbeat, very different sound to it. Plus a science fiction motif in there as well.
Yeah, a little bit. So I was in band all throughout middle school and high school, and I played the piano before I was in band. And mm-hmm. so a lot of the time, the scores for me are really huge, and I enjoy listening to the music, and I'm one of those where if I have the music and I download it in my iTunes, I'll be listening to it in my car, and I can see the picture, and I can see the certain points in my mind in the movie, so the music for me can be a really big thing. It can be a turn-off or a turn-on for a film.
Yeah, well, it's great that you have that kind of ear. I've always loved the music and have a ton of soundtracks myself. But what I always thought was interesting is the different eras. Like my kids, my oldest son is into music. He's quite the musician. Sounds a lot like you, actually. You know, piano, guitar. He hears it. He knows it. He plays it. You know, those type mm-hmm. of. I don't know where the heck he got it. I'm still looking for the possible. Anyway, I don't want to go down that way. So anyway, he just has an unbelievable talent and a gift. But when I was growing up. You know, you saw the movie. It might come on TV 2 or 3 years later. Mm-hmm. VHS wasn't that big until 1982, 83. And even then, you know, you were talking about renting movies, and there was no instant access. So like you, I relived all the movies I watched through the soundtracks, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, could see it in my head, and just like you, it really, I think, got a decent ear and pay much more attention to it. And it's interesting that you said that again. You know, we didn't talk about that off mic, and I find that to be really interesting. And I find people that have that ability and that appreciation for the music to be, you know, that much more interesting to me, because it's a common point. And that's why I really enjoyed Melodic Treks. I mean, that was a great show. And, you know, it was a lot of fun to kind of go back and see and listen to all the different tracks and follow the different composers. And it's amazing in the Star Trek world how many people are like that.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, so I went to, they had that Voyage, the 50th Voyage concert that toured mm-hmm. around. And my best friend and I went down to Salt Lake for that, because that was the closest that it came. And just absolutely moving. I love it. Like, I went to the concert in Vegas several years mm-hmm. ago when I went. And I'm sitting there crying, you know, and it moves me very deeply. But I appreciate that because of all those years of being in band and appreciating music and learning to appreciate it.
So the beat of the music, I mean, like I said, it had a very, very upbeat kind of fun sound to it. You know, it was very, like you had mentioned, it wasn't as dark as mm-hmm. the others. I don't know how dark, the movies were definitely dark, Star Trek II and Star Trek III comparatively. Star Trek the Motion Picture, I would say, was deep, but they had these big bombastic scores.
Yes.
Right, and now you've got this, which... you know, it just gets a feel to it, and it makes you smile, especially the end credits. I always thought that was kind of neat with the pictures going along with it. So that's cool. We'll have to circle back to that. So the music right off the bat grabbed your attention, and it mm-hmm. and it made you feel pretty positive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely. So did then the movie live up to the score type of thing?
I would say so. I mean, it definitely did. There was a lot of. I liked the humor in it. It was a little sometimes on the nose, but also pretty subtle. And I enjoy British humor, so mm-hmm. I like the little drier sometimes, but definitely that subtle humor where it's funny, but it's not ha-ha funny. It's just like, oh, that's really like chuckle funny
right,
for me.
Right.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
So that was, it definitely lived up to it, I think, for me.
Yeah, I hear you. I think that was what the appeal was, because when they were making this movie and Leonard Nimoy was putting it all together, because he directed Star Trek III, and he kind of had said in a lot of interviews that the first three movies, especially the second two, was a lot of death, a lot of destruction. I mean, we lost Kirk's son, we lost Spock, we lost the Enterprise. It's just heavy, right? And he wanted to do something a little bit lighter. And as we mentioned when we were talking about you and your rewatch or your first watch of the original series, that there was a lot of great comedy, you know, mm-hmm. and these guys could pull it off. And they always seemed to work best in that fish out of water scenario, like they did in A Piece of the Action, right? Yeah. They weren't technically trying to be funny. They were just funny. Because they were trying to pull something off, and that's a lot, I think, of why Star Trek IV works so well. It wasn't slapsticky. It was just, you know, these different things and circumstances, and, you know, Spock jumping in and doing a mind meld with a whale. And, you
know, yeah, that was funny. I think that was funnier the second time that I watched it. So I watched it once just to watch it, and then I watched it again and jotted down different things. So the second time I saw that, I was like, yeah, that's actually, I'm like, Kirk's reaction, and he's sitting there like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? But Bones, I think Bones trying to talk to Spock and get Spock to be Spock before mm-hmm. three was great.
Yes, that he would actually have to die to have a common point of reference. Yes. I thought that was pretty good. No, I agree with you, Haley. I think that they pulled it off well. Maybe some things were on the nose, but you know, all in all, I think for longtime Star Trek fans that really at my age back then, which was 20 on the nose, 1986, the ability to see the characters, and I had met all these folks in numerous conventions because that was so big back then. To see them in a movie like this, where other people for the first time could watch Star Trek, mm-hmm. not have to try to figure out, you know, what's the thing with the pointed ears? And I don't, Federation, what's this? They don't get it. But yeah. This movie allowed them to sit there and just watch this tale of trying to save the world, to save the whales in order to save the world, and watch these guys go and just sit back and have a good time. And that was really... I think the crux of the film, right? It had universal appeal. The other piece of it that was really cool was over time, when you talk about like the best movies in Star Trek, even though this was most successful, among Star Trek fans, it's very rarely brought up as being one of the best, where I think it truly belongs up there.
Yeah. Well, and that was one thing you'd mentioned. I appreciated that there wasn't so much technobabble in mm-hmm. it. And I think that's why it makes it so appealing to people who aren't diehard fans or at least had watched plenty of the episodes and knew nuances and things like that between the characters and whatnot. There wasn't all that techno babble, which TNG and later on is definitely guilty of a lot of techno babble, and you kind of have to start from the beginning or you don't get it. And that was really nice, actually. It's kind of refreshing to not have all of that jargon.
Yeah. Well, as we both know as big TNG fans, that when you have to do, what is it, 26 episodes a year for 7 years, and you're trying to fill space and time, that's what they do, right? They start off talking about things that, you know, all the pseudoscience things that make no sense, and you just go, oh, okay. Yeah, of course the, you know, the matter flux inducer doesn't work. Dopey? Yeah, whatever. So let's go a little bit and talk about the message from Star Trek IV. Now, you had said the comedy could be a little bit on the nose or bonk, bonk over the head. What was your feeling about the whole ecological message of this movie?
As a Earth lover,
mm-hmm.
I definitely appreciate it. I think that it speaks to a lot of devastating effects, even that just one species no longer in existence can have on our planet. You know, we have this cycle of everything is connected, and I think a lot of times we tend to forget that everything, even down to the microscopic organism, all the way up to blue whale, which is the largest animal on our planet right now, is all connected, and we all have this cycle, and you take one out of the loop, or you add one into the loop that shouldn't be there, and the effects ripple out into everything. And so I appreciated that, just because, you know, we need to take care of this planet. It's the only one we've got. And if we don't, then, you know, its effects are pretty devastating for all of us.
It's pretty well said, very well said. I think the piece of it that I liked was the fact that everybody was scrambling to try to figure out what this probe wanted, right? And for whatever reason, Spock figures it out, listening to it, and, you know, makes it, you know, what would this sound underwater, because it's aimed at the Earth's oceans, and they kind of walk into it. And that line that he said is, you know, only human arrogance would think that this must be made for man. Right. And I thought that was a kind of a critical thing to say, because it was one of the first movies. It's probably the only movie I know of where man may have caused it, but the probe didn't even act like people were there or that they mattered. It just wanted to talk to whales. And I thought that was kind of a nice twist on things. Right. It's like, why would you think that this message just had to be meant for man? It could be meant for anybody or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, with a certain level of intelligence.
Yeah. For me, it kind of brought up the whole, because we recently have watched in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy with my daughter.
Oh, God, yeah.
So I was like, oh, this is kind of the backwards motion of the whales are gone and this thing is coming and wants the whales to be there or we're all going to be gone. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I guess. I've read the books. I can't say I've actually seen the movie, but at any rate, that's what I thought was really cool about it. It kind of flipped things on its ears a little bit, and, you know, it made you think. And I think it helped to bring in Dr. Gillian Taylor. Catherine Hicks, I think, did a wonderful job portraying her and was very believable.
Yeah, she was thoroughly enjoyable. I liked her not taking no and pushing back. And I loved when she was having dinner with Kirk, and, you know, and he's talking about some of the stuff, and she's like, oh, tell me. And you want to think that she believes him, but then you're like, oh, she's being such a smart aleck about it. And it's great, and I loved that. I wish we could have seen more of her and Kurt together. Maybe that would have been great.
Well, I think it ended beautifully because she blew him off.
Yeah.
Right. And he couldn't believe it. And that was the other trope that this movie had a lot of fun with. And I think it showed a lot of development for William Shatner and his character a little bit, because he always got the girl. That was just the way it worked. Right. And there was always a love interest, and, you know, he's like, you know, as you say in your time, I don't even have your phone number. And she's like, I'll find you and see you later. Off she goes. Right. Yeah. And I thought that was just kind of neat. It was just a different turn on things, but I really enjoyed her a lot. And when she slapped the aquarium curator, that was very real. I don't know if you've ever seen or read any of the production notes or anything that they've, and the making of or whatnot. She didn't intend to hit him that hard, but they said, make it authentic. So the slap and the reaction was all real. She gave him a real slap. She was really pissed. So I thought that was pretty interesting little trivia there. And it made it even that much more believable.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing I think, like a woman slapping a man on the face, I don't think you can fake that and make it look genuine and authentic. You have to actually do it, because you won't get that reaction from, like, a fake one. I don't know.
All right, Haley, is that because you want to do it, or is that how you really feel?
No, it's how I felt. I've actually been a slapper. I've slapped a couple of people in the face, and yeah, you don't get a reaction if you don't actually do it with feeling. As we say in band, with feeling.
With feeling. Okay. Yes. Note for Las Vegas trip, don't piss Haley off. Got it. They'll know exactly. Why are you so red in the cheek? I don't want to talk about it. Yeah. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the message. We talked a bit about the comedy. What were your feelings about the whole kind of B and C plots here? You had Mr. Scott and Dr. McCoy connected for kind of the first time off doing their mission, as well as and Sulu was along for the ride, but he kind of got
sort of.
And then you had Chekhov and Uhura. What did you think of those dynamics?
I liked it. It was really fun. I loved Chekhov and Uhura trying to get to the naval base and asking the police officer. And I'm just like, you know, you do that now, you're going to get arrested. But then a friend of mine had mentioned, how did none of these people who went to Starfleet Academy know where Alameda is?
So it'd still be there.
It would still be there.
San Francisco.
So they had to have known where how to get there. And a friend mentioned that, and I go, huh, you're right. Yeah, if they'd gone to Starfleet Academy for all these years, they should know how to get to Alameda.
Well, you know, it's interesting. My wife was stationed at Alameda, and the base is long since closed. So that'll be my reason, is that if the base was closed in the 1990s, by the time they came around, they probably didn't even know it was once a naval base. But I'll throw that out there. But interesting facts about that scene. I don't know if you know this or not, but when they were asking the police officer and he's just looking at him, that police officer was just there to help with traffic and keep people away from the movie set.
Oh, that's funny.
And so when they were talking to him, his reaction is like, what are you talking to me for? And who are you people? And the woman who actually answers the question was just a pedestrian who got through and walked through and stops and answers it.
Oh my gosh.
They filmed it. And they had to chase her down and sign her to a quick contract.
Oh, my God. I didn't know
so
that. That's great.
Yeah, all of that was ad-libbed. Yeah, that whole scene.
That was
pretty cool. Yeah, all of that was ad-libbed. And then, of course, you had I thought was a pretty quaint scene was McCoy and Scotty at the factory there when they were looking at the glass and the plastics and so forth and the polymers. Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool.
I liked that. I thought that was great. I mean, I did find it odd that somehow, granted, yes, I get the whole Scotty talking to the computer, but then somehow he knows how to use the keyboard and he types faster probably than I could and knows all the programming, but didn't understand that he couldn't talk to the computer.
Well, he tried to talk to the mouse.
Well, he did try to talk to the mouse, but then he like types and he's typing all fast and he opens like the programming and I'm like, really? That was kind of a little unbelievable for me, just a little bit, but it was funny. I mean, I get it. A lot of people really like that scene. It's definitely a GIF you see all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I get it, but yeah, I just thought that was a little weird.
Yeah, and poor George Takei, they actually had a scene for him where, do you remember when he's walking down and he looks and he sees the big Yellow Pages ad on the side of the building? Well, there he was supposed to meet a little boy, and he talks to the little boy, and he discovers that that little boy is his great-great-great-grandfather. And they did film it, but the kid was just awful and kept breaking down and crying or whatever. Aww. And so after so many takes, they just finally said, we surrender. So he didn't get his little scene. Because everybody had their little moment for the most part. Uhura's not so much, you know, just more or less with Chekhov. But that was why his role seemed a little bit diminished compared to the others.
Got it. That makes sense. Yeah, he kind of disappeared and then he came back and I'm like, wait, what, where has he been this whole time?
Yeah, he was learning how to fly the Huey, right? So
yeah.
you have Scotty who could type and you had Sulu who could fly a helicopter.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe. I think they're pretty much the same, I suppose. Gonna suspend a little disbelief and have some fun with it.
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, it's great. I thought it was really funny. I loved the, I think one of my favorites was Chekhov when he was being chased off the ship. The music in that part was hilarious. I love that bit. But I thought that was great. And I thought, man, it would have been really funny if they had beamed him off before he fell. But then you wouldn't have everything else afterwards. But I thought that was kind of, I'm like, oh, that would be kind of funny. Because then he's gone and then they're all like, wait. But yeah, anyway.
Well, come on, McCoy in a 20th century hospital, you wouldn't want to lose that
that's
scene.
That's true. Right. And that's why I said, you know, everything that comes after with the hospital and stuff, that was great. So it's okay.
Mm-hmm. And they had a similar chase with similar music through the hospital as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was pretty good.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, did you buy the soundtrack for Star Trek IV yet?
I haven't yet. I have most of the 2009 soundtrack, but I don't have any of the other ones yet.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe a little bit.
What you'll find interesting is every single track has a very defined start and stop. So, you know, when you listen to movie soundtracks, a lot of time it just kind of fades away.
Mm-hmm.
But for each scene, it's like its own musical number, like its own song. So it's kind of cool when you listen to Star Trek IV because it's almost like everything is perfectly blocked out with the music. And you'll know exactly where they are and what they're doing as you're listening to it because it's just so locked into the movie.
It's I think different. A lot of soundtracks, though, I think a lot of the earlier soundtracks, because I had soundtracks when I was first buying CDs, I think they did that then. And now it's more of this fading in, fading out, fading into the next song, kind of, it's more flows rather than start and stop.
Yeah, maybe that's true. I'm so used to the movies. I had a lot of soundtracks, like I said, when I was a kid. And I guess you're right. I was trying to think to some of the bigger ones like Jaws and Star Wars and all the other Star Trek ones that I enjoyed. And I guess you're right. Close Encounters. I had them all.
That's them okay. All. Nothing I wrong with that.
No. Like I said, it was different times, but still great music. And there's some great soundtracks today. There's no doubt. But I was just trying to think. Yeah, I think you're right. That's why it stays so prominent with me because it was so different. And the composer was a good friend of Leonard Nimoy's, and that's how he got the gig. So, yeah.
Yeah, I did a little looking on him because I was wondering what else he had worked on. So, and that was kind of neat. I think there was a made-for-TV movie, and I was like, I remember watching that movie. So now I'm going to have to go back and listen.
Well, he did some Planet of the Apes. He did one of them, which was funny because he kind of tag teamed with Jerry Goldsmith, who did the original Planet of the Apes, and then like Leonard Rosenman followed him. But if you listen to melodic tracks, I wish I could tell you the episode number, but there's not a ton of them where we talk about Star Trek IV. Brandon plays them, all the different tracks, and it's really fun, including we had to put in there the trailer for it. There was a terrible movie that came out in the mid-70s called The Car, and it literally was... They took Jaws and they just put it in a car. And the car just drives around and runs over people. And it has no driver. It's just a possessed car. Bizarre. It is the most bizarre movie. Somehow it can jump up and leap and get people in kitchens. It's bizarre. It's bizarre. So we played that trailer in there too. And unfortunately for Leonard, that was one of his soundtracks.
Oh, no.
So that's where I was going with that one.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. There was it was The Face on the Milk Carton, and it was a made-for-TV movie. I remember it. I probably haven't watched that since it was on, but I remember it. And I thought, oh, and he did the music for that. And I thought, I remember watching that.
Was it like an after-school special? It sounds like one.
Kinda. It was. Basically the story, you know, and they had the face on the milk cartons of kids that had gone missing. And the whole premise of this kid was kidnapped anyway, and years later, his face is still in the milk carton, and the kid sees it and was like, I think that's me, that looks like me, and discovers that, you know, this other family, so the family takes the kid back, and then obviously the kid's like, whoa, what is going on, because I didn't grow up with you people, you're not my family. Anyway, yeah. I think it was like late 80s, early 90s, one of those movies.
Sounds like it's deserving of its own podcast to me.
No.
No? Wasn't that good?
No.
So let me ask you this. So at the end of the movie, spoilers, right? When when they do bring the whales back, which was kind of, you know, kind of neat, right? They stop the Russians from harpooning the whale, and they beam them in, they get the whales back. And I always thought the effects were really, really cool of the whales under the water and when it turns and then the probe matches that. But you don't know what they're saying to each other. Was that something that you thought was kind of cool and mysterious, or were you looking for some subtitles?
Yes, it was really neat. I thought that was kind of, you know, but then at the end I was like, I wanted a little more answer, even if I didn't know exactly everything that happened, everything that was said between the probe and the whale, at least a little something. I kind of felt like it ended and then it just, and then you're like, but wait, what? Yeah, I wanted a little bit more.
Okay.
What about you?
Well, you know, when I saw the movie, I did at the time, but then, you know, I listened to Nicholas Meyer and others just from different shows, and they talked about allowing certain parts of your imagination to be part of the story. And, you know, it was kind of a growth thing for me. And then, so I kind of looked at it through that lens and I said, well, what do you think they're saying? It's kind of like with the glove on Khan. They never explain why he wears it. And he doesn't know himself. And his question is, well, why do you think he wears it, right? Because they like to flip things on you. So it gives you some, you know, it allows you to have a little bit of freedom of, I guess, you know, what do you think they could have said? And it allows for some debate because it isn't cut and dry. So I thought that was kind of neat. Now, if you buy the novel, I'm pretty sure I have spent a long time. I do have it up there on my bookshelf. I'll have to go look, but I'm pretty sure in the novel it does say what was spoken between them.
Okay. Yeah, I'm too logical, rational brained. I want to know.
You want to know?
I'm not a major imagination, make it up myself. Like I probably could, but at the same time, I'm like, nah, my brain's not thinking that way.
You know, that's interesting because you're a musician. And yet you're very logical.
Yeah.
So do you play the notes as you see them, or are you able to also get creative with your music and just go on your own?
I would, when I was playing, I haven't played in years. I played the notes as I saw them. I think I put emotion into when I played. And sometimes depending on whatever piece we were playing, I could put myself into the music, you always do, but I played the notes as I saw them.
I see. It's just interesting to me because by and large, I don't feel that I'm a very creative person. But as time has gone on, I've had more and more feedback. Like because I use a lot of tools in order to problem solve, right? There's certain ways to get at root cause analysis. There's certain ways that you organize structures and make sure that everything kind of flows. And I like things to be somewhat linear and not too web of commandy. That's just my style. So, you know, it's very da 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 da. But I don't know if I've always been, like you said, you're logical. And so when people that are musicians, I always assume are extraordinarily creative and have a different view of the world. And I usually am very envious of those folks because a lot of times they can problem solve and do things as well as people like me who are very tool usage and very formulaic. Sometimes it takes them a little longer to get there, or they get there and I can't figure out how the hell they got here. I sit there and I go, this makes no sense, but they do it. So that's where I was kind of going with that because I don't feel I am creative when I can have some license to kind of think about it. I enjoy it. So I've just gone full circle back to that scene. And that's why, you know, it didn't bother me too much. And there have been other movies since, right? Like there's been a lot of talk about Tarantino lately. You know, what's in the case in Pulp Fiction, right? Nobody knows. Or Ronin or any of those movies. Like, they don't tell you what they're chasing or trying to get at. Now, there's a part of me where that drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. So I understand what you're saying, but then there's other parts of me. It's like, yeah, there's been so many discussions about what could be in that case. If the movie is done right, it creates more interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it creates a talking point, and everybody can have their idea about it and whatnot. And I'm not saying I have to know, but just even knowing just like a little bit more of like, or at least an idea of what the whole thing was about would be good for me.
Yeah. Well, like I said, there is an answer and I can get it for you. So we can solve that great mystery. If you must know, you will be told. So what I'll do is I'll go find the book. It's not very long. I'll probably put it in the show notes so other folks can get at it and share that great information of what the conversation was between the whale and the probe.
Yes.
All right. So what did you think, you know, after watching Star Trek IV, and I know it's been a while since you've seen Star Trek III, but you've been catching up on the original series. You've seen Star Trek II. Did you think at the end when they had the court-martial, I won't ask you what you think. I'll just ask you what your thoughts were with the team coming together and the punishment, quote-unquote, that they've gave Kirk and so forth and so on. What were your thoughts there?
It's not surprising, given how much the crew's gone together, that they would all stand together, or that Spock would stand with them. You know, when the president is saying to him, "Why are you here?" And, you know, "I'm here with my crew. You know, I'm part of this crew, part of the problem." That wasn't surprising at all. I was a little surprised that they got rid of everything, even though they demoted Kirk. They got rid of all the charges except for one. That was, mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't surprising. Like, you'd expect that to happen just because we do get another film. So, but I enjoyed that a lot. And I never had noticed before that, because, you know, we go to Vegas, or I've gone to Vegas numerous times, you've been. They have that Monster Maroon group. And mm-hmm. I don't know, people can correct me if I'm wrong, but I swear everybody has the white collars and the white shoulder strap. I've never mm-hmm. seen anybody have the green or the blue or the orange, or it looks orange to me, at least on my TV it did. And I thought sure. I liked that division, because I don't think I'd ever picked up on that before. And that was, in that scene particularly, that was the thing that I enjoyed the most was, oh, I'd never noticed those color divisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've been consistent when they came up with the Monster Maroons, but white was simply command. So if you were a captain or an admiral, mm-hmm. you had the white, kind of like in the later TNG movies. You know, when they had their dress uniforms, Picard yeah. had the white, and the others had the different colors that kind of went. Well, they were all blue, right? They didn't vary. It was either blue or it was white, I think. And I'm the colorblind one, so I'm taking a guess on that. But you're right. I don't think I've noticed anybody walk around in different colors. I guess everybody considers themselves to be a captain or an admiral. I guess it's what it is.
Okay.
Yes. 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 Maybe us Trekkie guys have a big ego, right? If we were going to be in the show, then, you know, it'd be obvious to me they'd cast me as an admiral, wouldn't you think?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, yeah. Either that or, you know, crewman third class swabbing the deck. One way or the other. Yeah, I agree with you. I thought the scene played very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think it was bookended beautifully. You had the front end scene with the Klingon going ballistic and passionate. John Shuck played a hell of a Klingon, you know, as the ambassador in the front end. And then at the back end, when it all comes together and, you know, it's probably, I don't know, what, the 15th time they've saved the Earth or the galaxy or whatever, that the punishment definitely fit the crime. And now you have them going off into the ship. So I thought it was played very well. I think they closed it off and they allowed the next movie to take off and not be connected in any way. Now, it didn't execute, but that's too bad. But at least then, you know, it's kind of like, okay, here's the end of this little trilogy. We've got it set. These guys are all set for another adventure.
Yeah.
Little did they know that TNG was around the corner and was going to be the powerhouse that it was. And kind of, I wouldn't say it hurt the original cast, because Star Trek V on its own wasn't that great a movie. Star Trek VI was great, but it just was one of those things where it was like, okay, now we're going to get a lot of Star Trek.
Yeah, I can say I don't. Yeah, I've never seen V.
That's okay if you want to skip it. actually, it's funny. There are people out there that see Star Trek V like one of the original episodes. They say it's one of the most Star Trek TV-like episodes of the movies because of the chemistry amongst the group. But it's a rough script, and it really changes. But like I said, there are people out there. John Mills is one of them. Absolutely loves the movie, passionate about it. So you just never know. You know, it might click with you. And
yeah, I'm a firm believer in you have to see it all. Mm-hmm. So like I watched Deep Space Nine, and before I started, I had a friend that offered to give me a list of episodes to watch that would give me a gist of Deep Space Nine. And I said, no, I'm going to watch it all, the good, the bad, because mm-hmm. I might like something that somebody else doesn't. And other people might like something that I don't. And that's okay. But yeah, I'm a firm believer in watching it all.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we'll get to it. yeah, I'm sure you will. And I wouldn't say it's the worst Star Trek movie. I would not say that. There are others that are much worse.
Yeah.
But it's definitely its execution's a little rough, but it means well. And for me, being I am a 100% holistic Star Trek fan, so I like it all. But obviously, this is a show about the original series. It's my people. It's what I grew up mm-hmm. with. So anytime that cast got together, I was always happy. And Star Trek VI was a great movie, and I still to this day am just like, oh, you know, it's like anything big when it ends, it just kind of crushes your heart a little bit. But, you know, we move on.
Yes.
Right? All good things? I've heard that before. All right. So, Haley, give me your final thoughts overall on this movie.
Overall, I enjoyed mm-hmm. it. It was really fun. It was a lighthearted kind of escape from what Trek normally is. It had the Trek, but not deep Trek. So it was great. It was enjoyable. Definitely a lot of fun. I'll watch it with my daughter. She'll watch it soon because she didn't get to watch it, and she's kind of mad at me.
Uh-oh. Mom's in trouble.
Yeah, a little bit.
Well, that's okay. That's okay. Well, at least, you know, it'll be interesting to get her perspective of it, because kids seem to really like this movie because they can relate to it.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, she likes TOS more than TNG, and we watched TNG last year, so yeah.
Sounds like my kind of kid. Yeah, yeah. I like it. She's got taste. I'm just kidding, all you TNG people. I do love all of it. TNG is definitely my second favorite, so it's up there. And DS9, I love that too. So
yeah, it was a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you notice when you first did your rewatch of DS9?
Especially I actually watched it for the first time. So
oh, you did?
It wasn't a rewatch. It was like a first watch.
But you watched them all in succession. So you must have watched sometimes two or three episodes in a day, if not more.
Sometimes I have to go back and watch season 1 through 3 because I was finishing school and I don't have much memory of those at all.
Oh, okay. I did the whole watch thing with my daughter. It became a real father-daughter thing about 8 or 9 years ago. And it was wonderful because she wasn't really into Star Trek. Now she is. I think you saw her in Star Trek in Las Vegas. And one of the things I noticed about watching the first couple of seasons is how many times it starts with a Dabo table and that clicking noise.
Mm-hmm.
And so after a while, it was like I would mute it for the first 30 seconds just because that sound got so annoying if you kept watching them in succession. But
yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, yeah. So welcome to the Standard Orbit Tangents. We've had a couple of them here today.
Yes.
All right, so your final thoughts were a good movie. How would you rate it against the other TOS movies that you've seen so far? Is this the best one?
No. At least not for me.
Okay.
It's been so long since I've watched so many of them that in order to rate them all, I would have to watch them all again. Mm-hmm. I put this probably somewhere in the middle for me. It's close to the top, but it's not my favorite.
Yeah, I understand. And again, that's where it seems to fall with Trek fans. Isn't that funny? Like I said before, it was the most successful because it had the most appeal. But then you ask Star Trek fans, oh, Star Trek 2 and Star Trek 6 and from the TOS stuff. That's all I'm talking about. You know, they'll say those are the top two. And well, Zach loves Star Trek 3. I like the motion picture. So I get it. You know, I think that's pretty common. But yeah, I would say it's probably my third favorite out of the six or so. It's right there in the middle. I think you captured it well. You know, it's also nice if you just kind of want to relax, you know.
Because you are going to focus on anything or really think about what's going on.
Yeah, you can really just kind of sit back and smile and enjoy the music. And it's, yeah, I'm with you on that. Okay. All right, Haley. So where can people find you on the interwebs?
People can find me on Twitter. I'm the handle Trekkie01D.
I wonder what that means.
I have no idea.
Okay. If any of you guys could help me on the Babel conference, never mind. Okay. And you're on the Babel conference as well? Are you responding there? From time to time?
Time to time, a little bit. If you want me to see something, it's usually best to tag me in it because there's too much. I have too many groups on Facebook that I might not see it if you don't.
Well, you'll be part of the show tag for this one for sure. So if people have any comments or questions or their own thoughts on this, of course, we always welcome on the Babel conference. And, you know, once again, I really enjoyed sitting down and having a nice conversation with you and getting caught up. It's been really enjoyable for me, and it adds a different view of things. So thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yep. I hope you'll come back soon. And we'll continue our journey through TOS with you and maybe Chloe as time moves on.
Yes.
So
gotta start season three.
Season three and movies 5, 6 and seven, no, yeah, 5 and 6, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have to we need to watch 3 because we recently watched 2, and then she'll need to watch 4 because she didn't watch it with me. So yeah.
Okay. All right. Doesn't sound very logical to me, Haley, going out of order. But
I know.
All right. There Be Whales Here isn't the only thing we're discussing on Trek FM this week, so here are some clips from other shows across the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
I actually hadn't watched the show, I'm embarrassed to say, but I sat down and I started watching and recording episodes, and I immediately had an idea for a script because I found Data to be the most interesting character.
To the journey!
So you could have, like, you know, carbonated gog.
Carbonated gog? I'm trying to understand how this works. So the gawk are presumably a little squishy or juicy on the inside. So you're saying that in order to give them the appearance of life, they replicate it with carbonation inside the gawk.
Yes, to make them, like, pop and fizz. Kind of like an Alka-Seltzer, you know?
Like pop fizz fizz. Candy gawk.
Warp 5.
And I go into the job interview, and I'm just parroting back to him things he said in his interviews, but he didn't know that I was just doing that. I would say, the thing about Star Trek is that you could write a mystery one week and a Western the next week, and I'm literally word for word things he said in an interview. So that's how I always feel, and I joke with him now that that's how I got the job. But
the 602 Club.
When we're talking about the idea of context in history, I think this is the biggest issue that I see in this film. And with the Force Awakens too, and you put them together because they're going to make a trilogy, is look, writing 101, if you don't know the past and the future of your characters, you absolutely 100% cannot write their present.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcast. If you're an Apple user, get the show on iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well.
If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trekfm/contact. And look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm, and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at trekfm, or on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and of course in the Babel Conference. Type Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trekfm and click discussion on the menu bar. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron on the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find the current goals and different milestone contributions along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details on patreon.com/trekfm. Speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our great associate producers for Standard Orbit. We have Renee Roberts, Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, Tim Robertson, Nick Anastasio, Richard Marquez, and Corey Elrod.
Yes, thank you guys so much for your support for both Standard Orbit and Trek FM. So, Ken, if people want to find you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
Hey, you can find me hanging around the Babel Conference and engaging people when I have the opportunity. You can also find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @BostonSCPO, and we like to tweet out all our new episode information as soon as we get it, as well as our colleagues. So look for me there.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreonZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman series from the early 2000s. And you can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.